Hey everybody, Gary here, doing a little intro before the intro. This is our very first of what I think we're going to call Galaxy After Dark episodes. This particular one, which you've heard Becca and I talk about on the last couple episodes that went up, is our first of what we're calling Galaxy After Dark. It's a more adult content. This one is hot and broody characters. We have one coming up in a few weeks that's going to be about fan fiction. So I just wanted to shout out right here at the top of the episode, there's a lot of language in this one. There's a lot of thirst for not so great people in a lot of our favorite pieces of fiction and fantasy and just media in general. So maybe don't listen to this one with your kiddos. Okay, I'm gonna shush and let you get to the actual episode. Bye, guys.
Welcome to A Galaxy Not So Far Away. I'm your host, Becca.
And I'm Gary.
And today we have Kylie.
Hi.
Victoria.
Hello.
And Jenny with us.
Hello.
And today we're going to be discussing a topic near and dear to my heart, hot, dark, broody characters.
Amazing.
So, okay, I'll just say personally, I'm a sucker for dark and dangerous types, but before we start discussing, I just want to pose a question to the group. You know, we had originally pitched this as hot, broody villains, but as we were putting our picks together, I know, Jenny, you had a sort of position to the group, like, are these characters technically villains, or are they just not quite heroes, so what does everyone think? Are we talking about villains today, or are we just talking about some misunderstood babes?
I think it's a mix of both, because some of the ones I want to talk about are villains. They are not the good guy, and some of them are just a little more misunderstood.
I think I agree. I think there's definitely going to be both, or there's going to be characters who were villains,
mm-hmm.
but maybe were revealed
to
have something more complicated going on.
Yeah,
absolutely. Looking at the list of names that we came up with, I saw, you know, there are some characters that have more than one name, and some of us listed one name, and others listed a different name, and, you know, I'm sort of wondering how that's going to play out in the conversation.
Yeah, that's fair. I think also a lot of quote-unquote villains are, like, you have to look at the context of their story, and sometimes there are villains that act in ways that we would not personally act, but within, like, what's happening in the story, like, that's, like, maybe they could be, that's more kind of getting into, like, anti-heroes, I guess, which is...
Keep going, Kylie.
Oh, no, that was... Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say that that's also kind of, like, the Byronic hero, if we want to jump into that, because... Like, one of the main traits of a Byronic hero is that they have a code, but their code does not line up with society's code, usually. So, like, you can see integrity in these characters in that they're, like, very much consistent in how they act, but a lot of the times those actions are not, you know, quote-unquote good.
I feel like that describes, like, every character that I'm bringing, basically.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, all of them are doing exactly what they think is right.
Yep.
It's just society doesn't think it's right.
Exactly, yeah. Like, that's, like, maybe one of the most defining Byronic hero tropes, I think. Or characteristics, not a trope, really.
Yeah, that made me, what you just said, Becca, it made me think of, I studied theater, and one of the things is, like, if you're an actor or somebody that is portraying a villain or the antagonist in a story, then you, in order to, like, be believable, you have to, like, kind of
find something
you have
relatable
to,
with them.
It's like find to, relatable, but, like, if you're looking at, like, the character's motivations, you have to think that what you're doing is correct, because usually people don't go around thinking, oh, what I'm doing is wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. Usually people are like, no, this is what I have to do, or like, this is what, maybe people don't agree with me, but I believe that it's right, you know?
I studied theater too, so I totally know what you mean. I played, in high school, I was in Jekyll and Hyde, and I played, like, the prostitute lover, like, the sex worker, and she was, like, pretty, you know, she was a bad guy, I would say, and yeah, I definitely had to be like, well, how can I relate to her? How can I find justification for these motivations she has? And I think that a lot of the reason, at least for me, why I like a lot of these quote-unquote villain characters is because I feel like a lot of their actions I can justify in some sort of way.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, I know that I've teased the prop a lot, so I'm going to use it to get us started on the first person.
Oh my god,
yes!
This makes me very happy. You mentioned to me, like, separate from the podcast recording, that you had bought this, and I'm excited.
Yes, so I'm definitely sitting here holding my Kylo Ren lightsaber, and yes, it talks. And great. So I know that a bunch of us brought him, and I think that he's, like, the heartthrob of this trilogy. So let's talk Kylo Ren. What do you all think?
I didn't even consider, like, we were talking about whether this was supposed to be a list of villains or not, and I wrote Ben Solo and not Kylo Ren.
Yeah, I thought that you did that on purpose. I was like,
I did, because maybe it's because I read the Rise of Kylo Ren comic, because I've been, like, listening to the audiobook, and you get a lot more interiority for, like, what's going on in Ben Solo's head over the course of Rise of Skywalker, and, like, I love his character so much, and I feel so bad for him. I feel like, you know, the reason that he is the villain, quote-unquote villain character in the first couple of movies in this new trilogy is because he's been manipulated into that position.
And so I'm going to send this visual aid, if everyone will look down at the little chat and click on the picture I have sent. If you scroll down the image, the super handsome drawing, it's from Will Sleeney. He is the artist on the Rise of Kylo Ren series that is coming from Marvel right now. Mm-hmm. I think he's doing a fantastic job. I think he makes him look so good.
Oh, it's mm-hmm. it's great.
But going back to what you were saying, Gary.
Mm. I'm just gonna, like, lead a little harder on that. Is like that, like, the especially the what the Rise of Kylo Ren comic is doing is showing so much of, like, every step of, like, him becoming Kylo Ren is something that he's almost actively, like, I don't want to say avoiding, but part of him becoming the leader of the Knights of Ren is, like, killing an innocent. But it's not like he wants to go out and just, like, murder someone. A fight happens, and someone happens to die. Or, like, the first issue opens up with him waking up and seeing the destruction of the Jedi Temple, but he's not responsible for the temple burning. And it's just this public perception of who he is becomes who he believes he is.
If we're not using the, like, I assume that not everyone in this group has read the comic yet. Jenny, I know that you said you hadn't gotten around to it yet. So without that sort of backstory's kind of validation for, like, him, like, what do you guys think? Like, I see a lot of people on the internet arguing all the time whether or not they prefer Ben Solo or Kylo Ren. And, I mean, personally speaking, I'm going to have to go with Kylo Ren.
So, I think my position on, like, what they're doing with Kylo Ren's character. So, one, I definitely prefer Kylo Ren personally. But I do think that they have to be together. Like, they're not distinct characters to me. Mm-hmm. They're interwoven characters that are one. But I think...
Yeah, I do think it's weird when people, like, separate them so drastically.
It tries to uncomplicate it.
Yeah, it's not like a Jekyll and Hyde situation. Like, it's exactly. the same guy.
What's and the same problem that happens with Anakin and Darth Vader?
I was just going to say that.
Really? I disagree. Yes. I feel like Anakin well, so this was kind is what of an I was... asshole the whole time.
Well, so this is what I was going to say. So in... Going back to kind of the Byronic hero thing, the prequels, episodes 1, 2, 3, kind of tried to make Darth Vader into a Byronic hero.
You think so?
They do it retroactively, and it doesn't really work. Because Darth Vader is pretty evil.
Yeah.
Like, through most of the original trilogy. And so, I think what they did a lot better with Kylo Ren was to create that dynamic of kind of the tragic past, and understanding how that tragic past is kind of influencing his actions as they're happening. And that kind of makes us more sympathetic to him.
And I also think that when it comes down to, like the motivations, like, I feel like Anakin always had, like, a bigger bloodlust than Kylo ever did. He was just sort of, like, it felt like he was looking for an excuse to murder, not that he was, like, oh, I don't want to kill people.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it just, with... the whole Anakin thing, it just doesn't quite hold up, I guess, because it all was created belatedly. Like, Darth Vader does not have a tragic background that we know of, really. Even when he reveals that he's Luke's father, he's not, you know, super upset about it in that moment.
Like, the emotional vulnerability that they try to give us for Darth Vader is not anywhere near as meaningful to me as, like, you know, the end of The Rise of Skywalker, when they give us that real emotional vulnerability with Ben Solo's reveal.
Yeah. Well, I keep thinking about that moment, like, specifically in Rise of Skywalker, there's the moment where he reveals to Rey, like, what her heritage is. Spoilers for Rise of Skywalker, I suppose. And and he tells her, like, we can't go back. Like, you can't go back, just like I can't. Like, he believes that because of the things that he's done, that he will not be accepted back, even if he wanted to go.
Honestly, honestly, the quote, the whole, like, forget the past, like, kill it if you have to, like, I feel like there's so many layers to what he means by that, and, like, I feel like, you know, when he first says it, it's very surface level, but then you really get into the depth of, like, he's running from the past just as much as he's telling her to leave it behind, because... I think in some sense you're always supposed to get the impression that he knows everything about her and, like, doesn't want her hurt by that information.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a thing, right, with a lot of the characters on the list that we're going to talk about, right, is how do they negotiate, you know, their present self with their past self, whether or not that past self is, like, more villainous or less villainous than they consider themselves to be in that moment. If that makes sense?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Like, and that's where, you know, we become really engaged in these characters because it makes them more interesting.
I wonder if it has something to do with, like, because talking about the difference kind of between Kylo Ren and Darth Vader. And also, I wanted to ask Gary if reading the Rise of Skywalker novelization helped with this, but, like, kind of the humanization of these characters and, like, really diving into, like, where they're coming from and, like, that, like, what you said, Jenny, about their past and, like, how they got to the point that they're at when we meet them, if that has a lot to do with kind of creating this, like, subtype of character. Because if you look at Darth Vader in the original trilogy, he's just he's just like a robot man with a mask.
Yeah, he's not don't very know anything about him
except I that really he kills him, people. But he's a pretty flat, like, he's not a super dynamic character. Like, he doesn't change a lot over the course of the
series. And when he is moody in it, like, you can't really figure out why. You can't really, like, see his motivation for when he's like, ugh. Like, you're just like, oh,
yeah,
okay.
You don't know. So it's just interesting because, like, definitely Kylo Ren has that from, like, the beginning. Like, in Force Awakens, there's, like, when he removes his mask in that movie, and at that point he becomes more than
and his hair is perfectly coiffed.
Yeah, but he becomes more than, like, this dark figure, you know?
since you brought that up, I did. I actually made a note to talk about that scene because, like, I wanted to just sort of slam J.J. Abrams for a minute because you can see, like, that Rian Johnson knows that Adam Driver is hot, but J.J. Abrams doesn't because in that scene when, you know, Rey calls him a monster in a mask and he takes the mask off and you see it on her face, the, like, oh, shit, he's hot versus, like, in The Rise of Skywalker, like, I don't understand how easy it was for J.J. to make Kylo Ren look ugly in the rain. Like, he's a super hot, yeah, tall guy, and he just looked disgusting through so much of that movie, and I was like, fire J.J. Abrams. He doesn't deserve Adam Driver.
agree. I will say, though, like, since we did start this as kind of, like, the hot, broody villains thing, I'm always a sucker for a villain with a mask.
Mm.
I don't know why.
Such as?
Like, Bane.
Yes! Oh my God. God, I love Bane.
That's, like, a major one. But I love it when he has his mask on, when Kylo has. I really love what Rian Johnson does and, like, the unmasking of the villain and how that is kind of interrupting kind of mythologies of Star Wars from Darth Vader, who didn't really get unmasked until the very end. And I love that, but I also love him in his mask.
Speaking about Bane, is it controversial to say that he looked pretty hot when he, like, broke Batman's back?
No, well, it's not controversial right now. This is a safe space.
And I was going to say, we forgot to put the warning at the beginning of the episode, so I'll say it at the end and we can just edit it in, but I like violent characters.
I'm with you, Becca. I don't want you to feel alone.
I really appreciate that. I was like, a lot of silence right now. I get it, guys.
No. What I was going to say is one of the characters I was going to talk about is in the series I was telling you about in the last episode, and his name's Stryker. And he is tall, tanned, blonde, sexy, hot, but he will kill you and then go eat a sandwich. He does not care. And he has a vendetta against Apollo, who is his dad. And
like
he will,
the Apollo or just
like
a character
the
named
the Apollo. The
Holy
Apollo.
Shit. Okay.
Hey, wait, Victoria, what yes. series is this?
This is the Dark Hunter series. It is by Sherilyn Kenyon, who I will probably talk about every chance I get. But he is a descendant of Apollo, and Apollo basically created this race, which Stryker is, and then he cursed them to die when they are 27, I think. And the only way they can defeat that is by taking a human soul. And so, of course, Stryker's like, fuck you. I'm going to cuss. I know. Just bleep that out. He's like,
It's okay. This is a disclaimer episode. We can say fuck as much as we want.
Okay. He's like, F you. I'm not doing this. I'm not dying. I don't care that your mistress died and that's why you're pissy. So he decides to recruit the strongest of this race and be like, we're going to take over. And he doesn't care who gets in his way. He doesn't care who he has to take out. He's going to get what he wants, to the point where in one of the books, he slits his own son's throat because he thinks he betrayed him.
Oh my God.
Yikes. Yeah. He is
intense.
And he's That's hot brutal. While he does it. You're just like, it's okay. You're hot. I'm okay.
I feel like another character that you were gonna bring, I feel like Spike is also kind of like that. Very much Spike. Does like really fucked up stuff, but looks super hot while he does it.
For
sure. Like, oh, okay.
And until he gets that chip in his head, he is just balls to the wall, like, I'm gonna fuck shit up.
We don't have to talk about the chip.
And then we have, like, Angelus, when Angel goes bad, and even Spike is like, I gotta pause.
Spike's like, wait, hold up.
Like, wait,
you want to what?
Hey, we gotta pump the brakes a little bit.
See, Spike's, I feel like Spike's crazy, and Angelus is psychotic.
Oh, yeah.
Spike's like, wait, no, we don't go that far. I'm out.
Spike likes what humanity can bring to the table for him. Mm-hmm. To eat.
Yes. And Jealous is just like, burn it all.
It's interesting, though, thinking about how villain, like the villains themselves, like the lines that they draw in the sand and stuff. Mm-hmm. And is there, like, do you guys have, like, a line that you draw, like, when thinking about these characters, I guess? Is there, like, certain characters that you don't like because of the stuff they do? Or, I don't know.
I feel like I have a very complicated relationship with Spike since he has had his, like, non-consensual, like, intimacy issues. Like, I can't rock with, like, villain characters that, like, hurt, like, little children.
No.
Or, like, are rapists. Like, I feel like it's the same moral lines that I have with, like, human beings. Like, I can't justify those fucked up actions.
The one thing I will say in Spike's defense, because I know what scene you're talking about, is he always had that no, okay, yes relationship with Buffy.
That is true.
So he couldn't, and you have to remember, these guys don't know what it means to be human anymore. They don't know normal. So, I'm not in any way, shape, or form saying what he did is correct. But because he's so used to that, get away from me, okay, let's get it on, get away from me, okay, let's get it on, he didn't know she was being serious until he knew she was being serious.
Well, I mean, we also have to bring up, like, with the subject of that scene and Spike and everything, like, I mean, Joss Whedon is a super problematic person.
Oh, for sure.
So, I feel like stuff that was created through his lens, like, you know, is it, I don't necessarily, like, hate the character, like, but the person that made it so, that's a different story.
Yeah. I get you.
It's tough. The thing that I'm always interested in is, like, are there characters that you guys have picked on this list, or, like, others that you might not have? Characters that you do like, despite the fact that they're villain characters, who then have gone and taken a step too far? Like, I was a big fan, I wouldn't call him a hot or broody character, but I was a big fan of Breaking Bad. And the thing that's really incredible is watching Walter White progressively do, like, more and more terrible things to a point where I'm like, you know what? I actually don't like this character anymore. Maybe I never really liked this guy in the first place. He's been pretty problematic since the beginning. I was just more forgiving of it then.
I don't think any of the ones on my list, I feel like that, because I feel like once I reach that point of, hey, wait a minute, you've gone too far, even if I go back to, like, the first book or the first movie, I can no longer have that same relationship with them.
Sure.
So I put Aidan Gillen's voice on my list.
Yes, can you explain? I don't...
So, he plays Littlefinger in Game of Thrones, and I find the character absolutely deplorable. I do not like his character, but I will listen to his speech about chaos being a ladder, like, a million times. I just like the way he talks. I really am, like, engaged by it, but he's a horrible character. But am, like, very invested when he makes those speeches, because I love his voice. I don't know.
I mean, Gary, to your point, I mean, like, I think that the perfect example of, like, a villain character who I really loved, but then was like, maybe not, you're kind of a really bad person, the Joker, like, for sure, because, like, I mean, there's certainly parts of him where I'm like, I can see what all the hype is about, but, like, he, like, fucked Harley Quinn up a few too many times, and, like, also, like, assaulted Batgirl, and, like, just, like, a lot of irredeemable stuff. Like, when they're just doing, like, messed up stuff for the sake of, like, hurting people, and there's no, like, agenda, like, that's when I kind of have to step back and be like, oh, I don't think that I can like you anymore.
Yeah, it becomes tough, especially, like, I don't know. It's weird because the way that, like, media is so spread now, there's a lot of things that characters I discover, or, like, new franchises I discover that have been around for a long time, and you, like, discover that a character is problematic that you didn't know about. Or, like, the reverse happens in things like Jenny was saying with Star Wars at the beginning, where you have Vader, and then we're gonna go back and have the prequels and try to, like, make him sympathetic. Or, like, at least show what his fall was. And it's interesting, like, I'm always really fascinated in the arc of a character, especially in, like, franchise work, because they're going to keep producing content and keep telling more stories, and, like, when does it all just become...
I feel like there's a lot of, like, different franchises where lost. They've pushed it so far, like, trying to flesh out an arc of a character, that they lose the character's, like, essence that you actually enjoy in the first place. Like, I think that Anakin's, like, a perfect example of, like, too far. Like, when he was just like, yeah, I'll kill all these children. I don't care. Yeah, I'll kill the lady that I, like, got pregnant too. I don't care. I was like, I mean, at this point, like, there is nothing redeemable about you. Like, you had a choice and there was all this reason in your face and you just were like, what if no?
Yeah. It's especially tough. I have the hardest time with Anakin Skywalker in particular because I have, like, I have since, like, watched all of the Clone Wars shows and I have, like, read a bunch of the comics and the books and, like, I think that he was a terrible person and the stuff that happens in Return of the Sith or Revenge of the Sith is a devastating thing. And then there's a moment in the book Lords of the Sith where he just, like, something sparks a memory of Padme and he breaks the thing he's holding. Because he's still devastated by what happened.
See, like, and that's beautiful. Like, and also, like...
Yeah, and it's a weird... There's a weird balancing act that a character like that is playing.
Is it... Like, I'm just like, I don't know. When, like, really, like, villainous, like, strong characters, like, break shit because they're, like, emotional. I'm like, that's kind of hot. Like...
Right? And then we... But we can also just say, like... You really have done some, like, terrible things, and maybe you shouldn't be redeemable, necessarily.
On the subject of, like, redeemable characters, though, I was wondering if you and Victoria could talk a little bit about Prince Zuko, because I feel like he's a character Zuko. That was very all over the place, but ultimately I was like, you know what? I am on your side. Like, I do see where you're coming from.
I think Zuko's redemption arc is, like, the peak of redemption arcs, and every other redemption arc since then has been trying to, like, meet that
yes.
same
I agree
feeling.
With you 100%.
And none of them quite do it because it's just so perfect.
It's interesting, just, like, you know, even from the beginning, like, Zuko's a bad character, but he's kind of, like, on outs even within his own community, and there's something sympathetic just in that, in the nature of him being, like, the exiled prince on the run, and, like, this mission that he's on is the only thing that can bring him back, and his mission is about, it's about, like, finding the Avatar and delivering him to his father, but it's, like, the true thing, the reason Iroh is there is because it's about finding himself and, like, just accepting who he is, and, like, that becomes the reason that he's able to be, like, no, like, I shouldn't be in support of this, I shouldn't be trying to go back and appease my father, like, what do I care what he thinks? I love it so much.
I do too. I just feel like he's, like, one of the ones that, like, he's like that lost, like, soul, kind of like how another character I was talking about the other day, where it's like, he's like, again, I hate comparing people to puppies, but he's like the puppy that got hit one too many times, and now all he knows how to do is, like, snap at people.
Victoria, I wonder if, like, in every episode that you're in, you're going to be like, I'm going to compare this person to a puppy.
Probably.
I don't like comparing people to puppies.
Probably, because it's a perfect analogy. Like, people can understand, like...
Everyone knows dogs.
Yes, and if you don't, you just go away.
Oh my god.
But I do feel like he's just been beaten down one too many times, and now all he knows how to do is just kind of snap out.
I mean, on the subject, too, of princes, of scorned and, like, cast out princes, I think that we have to segue into Loki, because he is the epicenter of the cast out, broody prince archetype, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I just want to make one quick call back to when I was giving J.J. Abrams shit. I'm going to do the same thing for Loki. Kenneth Branagh, who did the first Thor movie, did not know Tom Hiddleston was hot. But Taika Waititi absolutely knew that Tom Hiddleston was super fucking hot.
Taika Waititi is a genius.
Taika Waititi should be the only one that directs, like, MCU movies, as far as I'm concerned, because he understands... that I want horny content. And he gave us that with Ragnarok. Like, when he tied Loki up, I was like, come on. What am I supposed to do? But something that I think is really great about Tom Hiddleston getting cast as Loki is it sort of gave a renaissance to Loki Lofason as a character in the comics. Because I don't know if you guys, like, read a lot of the comics before the, like, MCU movies. But, you know, he was, like, really, really pale, like, sickly. Like, he looked like he was going to die at any point. And he was, like, he was such a snake. Like, he was slimy. And he had, like, these ridiculously huge horns. And he was just ugly. And then they turned him into this. And if you will look at the chat, I've sent you another image. For the most recent Loki run, it was written by Daniel Kibblesmith.
Yes, please. That's all I'm going to say is yes, this, please.
This is a variant cover done by Babs Tarr, who she did the New 52 Batgirl. She did Motor Crush, which we have in the store. I really love her art.
Yeah.
I mean, just look at him. Like, he went from being, like, this really slimy, gross-looking fucker to, like, he knows that you want him, and, like, he's not mad about it. What do you think, Victoria? I know that you also share a love for Loki, and I want to hear your thoughts.
I do. Like, and I've loved Loki since I studied Norse mythology.
Oh, when he was a ginger god.
Because I just, you know, I love my villains, and just something about him. I was like, okay, I'm on board. And then Tom Hiddleston was playing him, and I'm like, now I'm really on board. Sign me up. I'll kneel. It's all good. I don't know. And then, like, just when you find out, like, the deeper layers of why he does what he does and how he's just wanting approval of his family. I mean, how can you not kind of be like,
well, I was
going to
bring that up, too. I feel like that's, like, a common theme we've been seeing in most of the characters we've discussed so far. They're basically all characters with super deep familial issues and trauma, and all they want is someone to love them and, like, give them a hug and be like, you're doing a good job.
It's like, it's okay. Everyone, we love you.
I was going to say, they're definitely, like, all vulnerable to loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's not always the case with villains, even when they are, like, disconnected from any sort of family.
Like, do you have one in mind?
Like Voldemort.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like Voldemort, who is very much alone the whole time, but he's not, you know, brooding about it necessarily. No. But then Snape is.
I was going to say, you have Snape, right? So do you want to talk a little bit about his
another prince
vulnerability?
So I can talk about Snape. So full disclosure, I did write a paper about this.
Oh my god, yes.
As part of my master's program, as part of a class on Byronic heroes. So
you are the perfect candidate to talk about this, is what I'm hearing.
I mean, I do love talking about Snape. And as my only other disclaimer is, like, I know that there's a huge resistance to him, but I also will say, after doing research of, like, fan responses to him while the books were being written and even while the movies were coming out, it's been in the last maybe 5 years that the hatred for Snape has, like, ramped up a lot.
Yeah, I've noticed,
like,
that
the fan
too.
Community has turned on him, and they have turned on Dumbledore.
I don't know why people are turning on Dumbledore. I will say, like, in the last, like, revelations of his character, like, I was not on Snape's side. Like, I didn't really like his motivations, but I still respect him as, like, a hot, broody villain.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Alan Rickman does a lot for him.
Oh, yeah.
Alan Rickman does so much.
Yeah.
But I have a huge soft spot for Snape, and I know he's bad. But I love him. He is my favorite character in the series. But what I, you know, what I've talked about a lot is he's essentially a Byronic hero. So Byronic hero characteristics are they have a code that is hidden or not the normal code, which is him kind of working behind the scenes through at least the timeline of Harry's life to kind of for the good, but not acting like it. He's also super wounded, which is another really, really big thing about Byronic heroes. And then he has, like, a fatal flaw. which is
what would you define his fatal flaw as?
So what I would say, like, his fatal flaw as a character that really makes him deplorable is how he can't let go of his hatred for James.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the part that, like, got me, like, feeling really weird. I was like, dude, this child is a full-grown, like, adult now, and you're still like, I hate your dad.
Yeah, that's like, and I mean, not excusing it, I get it, because James Potter was kind of, you know,
oh, an absolute dick.
Like, yeah. He was a huge tool. Uh-huh. Clearly, Snape is, like, super resentful and has not gotten past that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that, like, if I were to give him, like, a fatal flaw, that would be it, is that inability to let go, because that's kind of his downfall, in at least the eyes of the fans, in his ability to kind of become a public good guy.
I think it's interesting. The biggest resistance I've always seen against him, and it is something I kind of see where people are coming from, is people really don't like that they felt like he had a really unhealthy obsession with Harry's mom, and, like, kind of couldn't take no for an answer and, like, move on, and, like, that was something that motivated his obsession with Harry and, like, looking after him and stuff. And I was wondering what your opinion is on that.
So my opinion is I've probably been, like, brainwashed by, you know, patriarchal cultures, but I'm still a sucker for unrequited love. And that of a story.
I absolutely agree, because there's still definitely a part of me that's like, oh, but, like, the fact that, like, Kylo's, like, joined me and Rey's like, no, and I'm like, that's so hot, but, like, I know that that's, like, fucked up.
Yeah. And, like, I have a friend who teaches a class on Harry Potter at Cal State Fullerton. And one of the things she talks about a lot is that, you know, one of the main things in Harry Potter is the power of love, because love is what saves Harry. It's what saves them time and time again. And so Snape kind of holding on to his love for Lily also helps save Harry at the end. So I don't know if that makes it better or worse, but it definitely ties back into other kind of patterns of love saving people in the Harry Potter series.
I do think it's interesting that I feel like Snape is maybe the only, well, no, because we have, like, Spike and Angel. I was going to say Snape is one of the only characters on these lists that is motivated by love. Like, and that's sort of where his blind spot is, and a lot of his driving force behind doing maybe not, like, the best stuff necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, Spike is majorly driven by love.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, it definitely becomes a dangerous love, but even from the beginning, his love for Drusilla is, like, all he really cares about.
Victoria, do you want to talk about that a little bit? I heard you.
Well, no, that's just what I was going to say, is even from when he was human, he was spurned by love, and then he's turned, and then he kind of just leeches onto whoever loves him, and he's like, this is my world now. And everything else can burn, and I will burn it myself.
Burn them and turn them, right?
Yeah. I love the episodes where we see Spike as human, when he's William the Bloody because of his bloody awful poetry.
Right?
I love those episodes.
I love them. They are, like, my bread and butter.
I do prefer Angel and Angelus, but I love Spike.
See, I don't prefer Angel at all.
I prefer Spike. I can't.
Oh, no, I'm with you, Jenny. I prefer
Angel. I can't let it go. Like, and I've watched it again, and I know, but I read so much fan fiction growing up that Angel is very different in the canon of my head.
Yes.
That is completely fair.
Like, it changed it. So I acknowledge that is, like, something I latched onto as a young girl and just can't let go of. And then as an adult, like, I understand that's bad. But I still love him.
Something I do want to touch on really quick is Gary and Kylie. I see that you two have, like, some characters from some book series that you're wanting to bring. And I'd love to hear about them, because I know a lot of the stuff we're talking about right now, like, a lot of us are familiar with and can speak to, but... I'd love to hear about your guys' characters.
Well, I wanted to bring up the Villains Duology by V.E. Schwab, who, she's one of my favorite writers ever. But there's two books. The first one's called Vicious, and the second one is called Vengeful. And they are excellent. And basically the premise is it's sort of set in contemporary times, but the world is a little different in that there are people that have superpowers. And there it takes place at the beginning of Vicious, which is the first book. You have these two college roommates that are both scientists, and basically they kind of decide to team up on their thesis project, and they're trying to figure out how people get superpowers and if they can like recreate it in a lab. And basically they do figure out how to do that pretty soon into the first book, and through various hijinks and kind of really super dangerous experiments that they perform on themselves, end up with powers. So one of them, Victor, he has the ability to just to not feel pain, and to kind of like control his senses, like his physical sensations. And then the other character, Eli, he is able to like regenerate. The premise is that these two people are granted these powers, but then they're both just kind of not great people just to begin with. And it kind of starts this really vicious cycle, title drop, of just like back and forth them kind of going at each other because of the ways in which they both got the powers. They like damaged each other and like betrayed each other. And so it kind of creates this enmity between them. And then at the same time, you have Eli. He has this motivation that he basically ends up believing that everyone that has these like powers, all these like special extraordinary abilities, are like abnormal and like unnatural, and they need to be destroyed. So he's like,
yeah, he gets very much that like anti-mutant sort of like vibe that you get in a lot of the X-Men stuff. Like he's this is wrong and we shouldn't exist, but
so he basically becomes like this vigilante and goes around and is like taking out people like him.
So obnoxious.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating because it's like the entire like almost the whole cast of characters are all like villains, more or less. There's like this one girl that she's a child and she's adorable and she is not a villain. And Victor, it's like my favorite trope, the like super broody, angsty character is confronted with sudden and inexplicable parenthood and is like, okay, well, I'm adopting this child.
And it's just stupid. Like, I like that in, like, books, but, like, movies that try to do stuff like that make me, like, cringe. Like, I'm like, I don't want to see this, like, buff, broody mask man, like, raise a child, but...
See, I like when they do it in you.
You don't. I do.
Like, I feel like one just came out with, like, I don't know, but he's, like... No, maybe. I don't know. It's like a movie that just came out, and, like, this little girl finds out that this guy's, like, a special agent or whatever.
Oh, I know.
And then she's like... She's like, you gotta teach me your cool stuff so I don't tell. And I'm like, I hate this.
That is not the one I was thinking about.
Oh. Well, that's not what happens in these books. But it's really good. So she's like one of the few that is an innocent party. And so it's just interesting to see how V.E. Schwab kind of sets up this world and this cast of characters that they're all pretty much... For the most part, like 80% of all the characters are objectively villains. Like you would consider them not great people. But that's the majority of the cast, it's like you have people that you root for and people that you don't. And like people that you're like, that you're on their side, even though like if they were in any other context, like with any other group of people, you'd probably be like, "Oh wow, you're pretty messed up." Like, but it's just the books are so good, kind of dissecting motivations and how, like, at what point do actions kind of push you over that line that we were talking about earlier in the episode, like the line that shall not be crossed.
Is that something that's like a reoccurring theme in that book? Is like characters crossing that line and you not being able to like stand by them?
It's kind of like I feel like she toes the line a lot in the book. Like, the people will do something, and it's fun because she also plays a lot with timelines. So it jumps back and forth in the story quite often. So you'll get kind of like motivations after, like, you'll understand why somebody did something after the fact, rather than like kind of a more linear timeline. So it's kind of plays with like you're like, oh wow, that was really rough and I did not like that at all, and then kind of going back and be like, okay, but this is what led up to it, and how you kind of go back and think about what happened in a different way when you have more information. And just kind
what
of
about
like,
I was just gonna say, Gary, what about Chorus of Dragons? Is it like similar in its sort of dealing?
So this is a very different. I mostly included Relos Farr because I knew that Kylie was gonna be on this podcast.
I hate him so much. I hate him so much.
The character?
The character.
Yeah,
oh,
so,
this is juicy.
So this character,
let's get into the discourse.
No. This character, Relos Farr, is like the big bad of the series, as it's been established so far. The subsequent books as they've been coming out, the Ruin of Kings is the first one. It's Jen Lyons, an author that I really enjoy. And as
we bow at her feet, she's amazing.
I knew you guys were gonna talk about her.
It's so good. But the thing that I love is that this series has played with has started, especially in like later books, to play with a timeline on such a far scale that like some of these characters have actually been around for millennia.
Yeah. Oh my god.
And Relos Farr is not a character that is like on a redemption path.
No.
At all. And in the third book, which is due out in August, they reveal some more of like who he was before he became like Relos Farr, the big bad that we've been facing for the last two books. And even as you reveal more of that and you get some moments of like, oh, like he had friends and he had family and he had. And it just undercuts all of it because he's still just a terrible person. He's always been a terrible person and he's always going to be a terrible person.
I love characters like that where you're like, yeah, I don't care.
I watching him work. I hate everything he
does.
Yes,
I 100%
agree. Fascinated by
him. I love this character.
He's just, he's a very fascinating character in that his motivation is not, like, his core reason, as we understand it currently in the books, is not in of itself a bad thing. He's trying to more or less preserve the world from destruction, but his methods are highly questionable. And so that's, like, another interesting, like, villain trope, like, where you know their motivations aren't that bad if you kind of extracted them from the method, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean, for example? Like, whose methods are excusable?
Well, I was saying, like, the motivation would probably be excusable as opposed, like,
it's one thing to look at a character and have that character say, like, well, the things that I'm doing because I am trying to save the world from destruction. You go, that sounds like a noble goal. And then he destroys an entire city with a dragon attack. Like, that's not what you would do. That doesn't, you don't seem to be going after the thing you claim to be standing for right now, sir.
Yeah, I've always been really, like, I've always hated, but also at the same time been super fascinated by the villains that are like, oh, for the greater good, we have to perform all of these terrible things.
Atrocious
things! And you're just like, no, that's not, you shouldn't. It also made me think of, I know we said we weren't going to talk about him, Gary, but Thrawn, it just made me think of Thrawn. Like,
yes! Yes!
I love Thrawn. He is my favorite Star Wars villain, hands down.
Oh my god.
I didn't include him because I wouldn't really consider him, like, broody. He's more, like, Machiavellian, but his motivations are to, like, help his people and, like, fight this encroaching terror that's coming from outside of the galaxy, but his methods are pretty awful. So it's fascinating to look at those types of villains, you know?
I'm definitely going to butt in with my last villain and say that I think that she is exactly that type of villain. Poison Ivy absolutely is, like, you know, obsessed with plans. Like, they're her, like, main bitch or whatever. And she's, like, she thinks that it's, like, for the greater good. Like, she's, like, people are awful. They're destroying the Earth, which, is she wrong? I don't think so. And But, like, so much of what she does is, like, use plants in combat, and, like, it has to destroy a lot of plants in the process. So...
That's a good point.
Every time that she uses, like, a plant monster and it, like, demolishes, like, a whole park, I'm like, is this really the goal that you set out with? But, I mean, beyond that, like, I've always wanted, like, I think it'd be great, DC, don't steal my idea, to have, like, a story where she, like, her eco-terrorism sort of passion is utilized, like, to help combat, like, climate change. And, like, how, like, I think it would be interesting to have her in, like, a hero-type position where she's, like,
oh, yeah.
She's, like, look, you guys are killing the Earth, and I'm gonna fucking do something about it.
And then you can grovel at my feet.
Exactly. I did just want to plug on the subject of Poison Ivy, the last visual aid that I have, if you will look below.
I please. Love your visual aids.
So, Amy Chu, an amazing writer, did a, like, I believe it was a 6-issue miniseries called The Cycle of Life and Death, and it was a Poison Ivy standalone, which I love, because I don't feel like she gets enough attention. And just, like, a brief synopsis is, like, basically, it's a murder mystery type story where Poison Ivy returns to her life as, like, a botanist, as Pamela Isley. And she, like, ends up creating these, like, I'm just going to say pods. I know they're not, like, pods in the story, but these, like, plant pods. And she takes them home and they end up growing into, like, women and, like, they're her children, basically. And, like,
wow.
There's this, like, beautiful emotional vulnerability and depth to her character that, like, when she's just in the rogues gallery for Batman, like, as just, like, a regular villain, I feel like they don't give her any depth. They're just like, yeah, she's hot, she hates men, she loves plants, and she wants to have sex with Harley Quinn. And, like, that's enough for me, but, like, this, it's great. And, like, she ends up, like, having to, like, solve, like, her boss's murder, but he's, like, not dead, and, like, that might be a spoiler, but this came out so long ago that I don't care. But it's a really beautiful series. Poison Ivy is and always will be a feminist villain icon, in my opinion, and I love her, and that's all I have to say about that.
I know that this has come up a couple times, but do you think the reason that we love these characters so much is because there's an element of, like, vulnerability when you get more interiority in, like, who these people are?
Yes.
Like, as you were saying, for Poison Ivy, like, when she's part of the Rogues Gallery, she doesn't have a lot to do, but then when you get something where she's on her own and you get to, like, be inside her head a little bit, it opens up that character in a way that,
I mean, I will definitely say that, like, the emotional vulnerability that, like, characters get through these, like, further storyline developments for them, like, is appealing. But for me, like, I won't lie to you. At the end of the day, I love villains because I love, like, a good middle finger to the man. And I feel like most of the villains that I really love are very, like, anti-authority. Like, they're like, I think that my way is better. I want to, like, break it down from the inside out and, like, make things my way because I'm so certain that I'm right. And so, like, that's the biggest appeal about everyone I've discussed today from my list. Like, they're just so anti-authority. Yeah,
it's, no, it's amazing. The thing that's interesting is, like, because for me, a lot of the characters, I mean, both of the big characters that I picked for between Zuko and Kylo Ren are people who very much are, as you get to know more about them, they become more likable and more, like, sympathetic. Maybe I think I'm a sucker for redemption stories.
I like that's both. One of, yeah, I do too.
Go ahead, Victoria. Sorry.
Sorry. No, what I was going to say is I really like those stories, and the last character I really, really, really want to talk about, same author as before, Sherilyn Kenyon, she wrote Styx, and he, through books like Two till his book, he is just this guy you want to punch in the face with a 2x4 or a mace. Like, she makes you hate him through all of these books. And then I remember she announced his book was coming out and her fandom lost their minds because they're like, we hate him, why is he having a book? And the whole time,
they're like, she's what a like, waste of time.
They're like, the whole time she's like, you don't know Six, you don't know Six, just read his story. And then you read his story and you're like, I'm a bitch. Because the reason he does all of this evil stuff is so he is tied to his twin brother, Asheron, and Styx can't die while Asheron lives. And they live thousands of years. And Styx, back when they were human, lost his wife and his unborn child. And so all he wants to do is die, because everyone he's come to love has died. And he's like, him and his brother don't.
That is so tragic.
Him and his brother don't get along. Like, saying they're oil and water is like nothing. Like, they're like, they hate each other pretty much up until Styx's book, because Ash finally gets to see why his brother is doing all of this stuff to him. And so, like, you learn all of this stuff and you're like, wait, I'm supposed to hate you. I can't hate you anymore. Like, I'm wrong. And I'm. So that's why I really liked him as a villain, because you learn that while he's, yeah, a villain and he's doing shit he shouldn't be doing, there's a reason for it.
I love them both. I really also just love villains. I'm with Becca. I love, like, the redemption arcs as well. But I also sometimes just love villains. Like, in the first season of Daredevil on Netflix, I love Kingpin.
Oh, yeah.
I love how Vincent D'Onofrio plays him. Like, it was so exciting for me. And then when he shows up in season two, I screamed. I got so excited. I probably like flailed and accidentally hit Matt. But I love him. And like the other, I guess another one too, and I guess he's kind of in the middle, this guy, of the redemption stories. I think he's maybe one of the best characters in Game of Thrones, but it's the Hound.
I love the Hound.
I love the Hound.
I love him. He is my favorite. He is unapologetically bad. Like, he's still good, but when he does bad stuff, it's not because he's, like, got a hidden, like, it's just, you know.
He wants to at that point. At that point, that's his motive.
And he has no qualms about sharing that. Like, so, I don't know, I think villains are a lot of the time more interesting than heroes, or, like, Byronic heroes are generally more interesting to me as characters than like a Campbellian hero would be, which is far more on the straight and narrow. But yeah, like I don't know, I like the badness.
It's fun to have a character that has like those shades of gray or darkness or whatever you want to call it. I think it makes them more compelling in a way that just like a straight good guy type doesn't necessarily have. Mm-hmm. It's a complexity that I really appreciate in characters that I read and watch.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I feel like good guys are boring. I feel like even when they're like conflicted, it's usually boring. Mm-hmm. Like,
we might have to do an episode about good guys.
We might need a whole episode about Kylie's sweet boys.
My sweet boys.
Oh my god, these sweet sad boys.
I feel like if we do a good guy episode, I'm just going to be like, Tony Stark was a sad alcoholic.
He's Byronic.
And I love him. He's a
Byronic hero for
Tony
sure.
Tony Stark is Byronic.
I can't argue against that. I do like Thor a lot. I feel like he has big himbo energy.
I love Thor.
So he's a sweet boy.
Oh,
I love him.
He is a sweet boy, and I love him.
In the first movie, when he, like, throws the cup on the ground and smashes it into a million pounds.
That was so funny.
I love
And then, I don't know if you've seen it, but in the, like, in the DVD, like, in the extended, like, little, like, clips, there's a scene where he comes back to the coffee shop and, like, brings the, like, waitress a new cup that he's bought.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm sorry for, like, breaking your shit. And I'm like, you are an angel. I would die for you.
I love the characters that are pure of heart and dumb of ass, you know? They're just so good.
Absolutely.
Put that on a t-shirt, Kylie.
I'm going to cross-stitch you that, Kylie, and I'll bring
Please
it
do.
To you when this is
I feel like we can make that into a t-shirt.
It's
We should.
They're the best characters.
So just wrapping up this evening, because I think we're drawing to a close, unless there's anyone that we haven't discussed that anyone's burning to?
Nope.
Going once?
Good. I'm good.
All right.
I feel good.
What is on everybody's to-be-read list? I am currently still working on Hostage by Guy Delisle. I mentioned it in the last episode, but it is a graphic novel. It's a true story about a man being held prisoner. He's held captive, and most of the comic takes place in one room.
Yeah, that super comforting quarantine.
Oh, yeah. Makes me feel all warm and fuzzy.
I don't know if this came up earlier, I finished the Rise of Skywalker audiobook that I was listening to, which I really enjoyed.
I think you said it before we started recording, and I tried to stop you, but...
I think I did. Hence a lot of the Kylo Ren talk up top. And now I am listening to Christopher Rocchio's The Howling Dark, which is the sequel to Empire of Silence, which I loved. I wrote a review on the website for that one. I really enjoyed it. It's like space fantasy.
Oh,
cool.
Yeah.
I am currently rereading a couple things just because that is nice to do when you're stressed. but I'm rereading The Goblin Emperor by Catherine Addison because Tor.com is doing a read-along. And I wanted I needed an excuse to read it. And it is the exact opposite of everything we've talked about today, because the main character is the sweetest boy. I'm rereading that. And I also just started rereading Deathless by Catherine Valente, which is really good. It's like a retelling of the Maria Merevna and the Koshe, the Deathless myth from Russian folklore, but it's set in like late 1930s. In Russia, it's really good. Yeah.
Awesome. I'm still reading The Last Girls by Dmitri Brodsky, which I mentioned the last time. It's just a thriller suspense YA novel about three sisters, and they're just trying to kind of like survive high school on top of all of the doomsday prepping their mom is having them do.
Got it.
Which is great to read when the mom's talking about plagues.
Love it.
Great. Lovely.
Perfect.
Delighted.
I am finishing up reading Party of Two by Jasmine Guillory, which is the fifth book in her Wedding Date series, which is awesome. It's a contemporary romance series, but it's all really good. And so far, Party of Two might be my favorite one. It's really good. And then I think next on my list is Night Pleasures.
Yay!
Victoria. It's at the top of my stack right now, so I think that's where we're going next.
Awesome. Well, I just want to say to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. I want to say thank you to Austin Farmer for the use of our theme music from the album Bookshelf Symphony Orchestra. Most, if not all, of the books discussed today can be purchased on our online shop, mystgalaxy.com, mystgalaxy.com. And you can always find more from us on Twitter and Instagram at Mist Galaxy Books. Until next time, we'll see you again soon in a galaxy not so far away.